We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'm the president and founder of the California Rock Art Foundation. And what we do is we identify, evaluate, manage and conserve rock art both in Alta California and in Baja California. We conduct field trips, we have trainings, exercise, we do research, and in every way possible, we try to preserve, protect, and coordinate treasures of Alta and Baja California rock art, of which there are many and diverse. We also work closely with Native Americans and partner with them to recognize and protect sacred sites. So for more info about the fabulous California Rock Art Foundation, you can go to carockart.org. Also, I'm open to give me a call, 805-312-2261. We would welcome sponsorship or underwriting, helping us to defray the costs of our podcasts, and also membership in California Rock Art Foundation. And of course, donations, since we are a 501c3 nonprofit scientific and educational corporation. God bless everyone out there in podcast land.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions. Hello and welcome to the Rock Art Podcast, episode 25 with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Today I ask Alan to define rock art and revisit some of the ways rock art is made and interpreted around the world. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Rock Art Podcast. I am usually the producer and engineer on the show, Chris Webster, although I've been on a few of these. And we are taking the opportunity on episode 25 here to basically reintroduce you to rock art. We did some things like this in the beginning of the series when we first started back in the summertime of 2020. And, you know, we had Alan's career that we talked about for a couple episodes. And over the course of interviewing many guests up until now, Alan has discussed various topics on different types of rock art, styles, dating, things like that. But we thought, as our audience has grown, maybe not all of you have had time to go back and listen to every single episode. So we would have a little bit more of a foundational discussion about what rock art is, types of rock art, pictographs or rock paintings, and all sorts of things. So let me go ahead and introduce the star of the show one more time, Dr. Alan Garfinkel. Alan, how you doing?
Good. See, I don't think anyone has ever called me the star of the show before.
Oh, man.
I feel honored and in some ways showcased by the plethora of interesting narrative that you had. You did a great job, Chris Webster, in finding a way to sort of ensconce what we're doing in this journey of 25 shows so far. Did you ever think we'd get this far?
Man, I was hoping, definitely hoping. So this has been great.
Yeah. So let's give it a shot. And for the next hour, for the next three segments, we'll talk about some of the basics of rock art, and I'll riff associated in terms of things that may come to my mind in talking about this subject and sort of kicking off sort of the beginnings and preliminaries of understanding rock art. How's that?
Sounds good. Well, let's start at the basics. Why do we call this rock art? It seems like the word art is a little bit of a loaded term, because I feel like a lot of rock art could have been instructional or conveyed some other message. Of course, we'll dig into interpretation way later, but rock art seems to imply something. But, and I guess furthermore, you know, do you think that should be changed, or is it?
Well, there has been an ongoing controversy about what we should call the study of prehistoric and even historic remnants of imageries on stone. And for all we know, that again, the terms are found to be somewhat offensive to the indigenous people, mm-hmm. who are mostly the authors of the thing we call rock art. But then again, it's been around so long and people within the field know what we're talking about. So I think even though it's controversial, it's also a bit of a misnomer as well. Mm-hmm. But I think that will remain the terminology. Under this domain of rock art, And if you look it up on the Funkin' Wagnalls, you look it on the internet, you might end up finding that you're not, what shows up is the rock and roll art from the poster, the posters and other things like that. So just so you're well aware, but rock art is really the visual remnants of prehistoric and historic culture that is carved and painted on these rock surfaces throughout the world. And what makes it so interesting, it's tangible evidence, a symbolic record. These are often manifestations of the ways of life that in some ways can be totally foreign to us today. And sometimes people say these images were not intended for us to see or even to understand necessarily. And you're right to say that the term rock art is in itself misleading, because when you hear the term art, it typically refers to what, you know, indigenous to the non-Western view of preliterate people, or when we go to a museum, you know, on and on. But what we're talking about is not the conceptualization that the Western world calls art. We're talking about an experience and a feeling and a set of sensibilities of imagery on stone that have an entirely different set of purposes, understanding, implications than we would feel when we sort of envision or think about the term art and art galleries and art museums. What we're talking about is it is a form of communication, but it is also a commemoration. When we go into a rock art site, I sometimes call it a memory palace or a place of personal immortality, which is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it really is.
To coin a phrase.
Yeah.
If I'm going to turn the tables on you, what do you think about when I say the term rock art? Does it envision something to you? Or, you know, if I shook you in the middle of your sleep at 3 a.m. and I said, define the term rock art, what the heck does it mean to you? And what does that envision? Or, you know, given your experience in the field of archaeology, how would you think about it?
Well, I think that's the key thing right there is my experience in archaeology, because it's weird saying discovered rock art, because clearly a human made it. So I've made the Western discovery of rock art several times on sites.
Yeah, right.
And prior to being an archaeologist, you know, I really hadn't seen that much rock art in my life. I was aware of it, but I would have actually thought of it as art, not really having that concept of it. But like you said, it's such a term that's ingrained in our academia and really the society of people that know about these sorts of things. But now when I hear it, I don't even put the word art on it. I see it more as a functional type of thing. Some of it could have been art in the sense that we think of it, but I have a feeling personally, just from my really limited study compared to, you know, you and the guests you've had on the show, I have a feeling that most of it is probably more functional. It was trying to convey some sort of message or accomplish some sort of task. Maybe that task was, as they say, some sort of hunting magic or something like that, but still conveying a message or performing a task. Now, it could be argued that art performs a task as well, gets you to think about something, gets you to do something. And maybe that's along those lines, but we see something put on a canvas. The canvas in this case is rock, and we think art, right? When we see that, if somebody puts graffiti on the side of a wall, they see graffiti is still art, but it's, you know, it's just in a different classification. So, but I think you're right. I think it does a disservice to the Native Americans by calling it art.
Right. I mean, she doesn't want to call it rock art per se either, but I think the function or the association of these images is in my mind often, not exclusively, but often, or if not in the lion's share, associated with what we might call ritual, religion, ceremony, cosmology, all of that. These are areas that even to this very day, the Native people, when they see it, they know it's sacred or it is full of power from an indigenous standpoint. And it's something to not be taken lightly. And as one goes through it, it's sort of an outdoor church or a place of veneration or connection with the supernatural, the celestial, the set of deities and super mundane beings. It's a portal also. It's a portal to another world, another time, and another dimension. How's that?
Well, I think that's good. But I think we also have to be cautious by going that direction as well. I mean, it's a common joke amongst archaeologists. Right, I just saw another meme about this on Facebook where we don't know what something is, therefore it's ritual.
It's religion.
So we got to be careful going the other side.
So you can't throw out the baby with the bathwater or drink the Kool-Aid, right?
Right. Yes.
But needless to say, we have rock art all over the world, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands
of sites.
But importantly, these are often somewhat fragile. Certainly the paintings are fragile, and even the rock drawings have some level of fragility in that these rock art sites, rarely are they being refreshed. So they are subject to both cultural and natural erosional and elements that will degrade their nature. Although in certain circumstances, they've been preserved for tens of thousands of years. So I think in some ways it's one of the most visible parts of the archaeological record. And I know I would argue it's one of the most informative. And I think even the general populace would say, you know, it might be one of the more interesting parts of archaeology. Yes?
Yeah, indeed. There's so many facets to it. Yeah.
It's a thing that's visible, and I think it engenders people's imagination and interest. And I guess you would know this from the thousands of episodes that are on the Archaeology Podcast Network. Are people interested in rock art? I think so. Yeah, I think so.
I mean, absolutely. Yeah, we've had guests on talking about rock art in a number of countries, actually, on other shows. And it's always a fascination. And I think it's because it's one of those things that we still don't have a lot of really solid answers to. And I think that's what kind of drives that fascination. And, you know, along those lines, you know, with some concepts in archaeology, we look at, say, what we call ethnographic evidence, where actual people have been interviewed, whether it was near the turn of the century. You know, you have early anthropologists, or, you know, maybe they didn't call themselves that, but a lot of times, you know, like missionaries and things like that, just interviewing older members of a population that may have been around even in like the 1850s, stuff like that, and finding out, you know, a little bit of information about what they did. So I would wonder in certain areas, you know, because I've never really heard, and again, I'm not really plugged into this whole thing, so maybe you have, but I've never really heard of any Native American groups that continued to produce rock art up into what we would call modern times, like up into the, you know, 20th century, which, given that information alone, because a lot of the rock art we find typically tends to be a little bit older. We'll talk about how we know that in some dating stuff later on, but a lot of it tends to be older. And like you said, if not a few hundred, a few thousand or 10,000 or more years old. And it makes me wonder if some of the religious significance we put on it, even from an ethnographic standpoint, where Native groups have been interviewed and said, oh yeah, that's a spiritual thing. I wonder if it gains sort of a spiritual atmosphere amongst the modern groups because they stopped producing rock art, and it's this ancestor relationship, right? It was produced by the ancestors, ... spiritual significance, you know what I mean? But the ancestors that created it didn't necessarily have that.
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question. It's sort of at the heart and soul of some of the controversy surrounding rock art.
Right.
There's an ongoing element, which we've tried to put to bed several different times, about whether most or much or the lion's share of rock art actually was produced by ritualists, people we call shamans. And if they did indeed do this, and if this was the commemoration of those trance experiences, as many or most of the archaeologists have begun to believe, then one of the questions might in fact be answered, that one of the reasons we have a hard time understanding this is we're not shamans. And also we're
right.
We're not people who have been sort of inducted into this deep and abiding cosmological sphere that Native people have relating to the land, the sky, the earth, the underworld, and all of these mysterious forces and beings that inhabit this religious frame. And so to truly understand some of this, and I'm not trying to overemphasize the religious aspects, but as you're well aware, when you come to understand indigenous thought, the fabric of their lives are
simultaneously religious and non-religious.
Mm-hmm.
So everything they do is veiled in a very cosmological, celestial, supernatural realm. Nothing, religion and the ordinary and the supernatural are one thing. There's no difference. There's no, there's an interpenetration of that veil. So, and that has been remarked on by many anthropologists and archaeologists trying to better describe and understand Native people.
No, that's interesting, because one thing I was thinking of while you were bringing that up was, I always like to think about kids in archaeology, right? We always find, you know, projectile points and arrowhead stuff, things like that are of, you know, maybe a good material, but sufficiently lower quality than you would expect from the area. And maybe somebody just wasn't very good at making the projectile point, or maybe a kid did it and they were being taught how to do this trade or skill that wasn't a trade back then. It was just like, you need to know this because this is how we live, right? And it makes me wonder if on a more traditional rock art panel and I say that because you do have areas like in Little Petroglyph Canyon. I've been to the New Mexico Petroglyph National Park where, man, it's just like boulders all over the place at varying heights. It's not like a wall where you would think when you see rock art. But on those wall type rock art features, if it were a family affair and people were basically just using it to pass the time and draw shapes and stuff, I feel like you would see probably more sophisticated things at adult height and less sophisticated things at child height, because children are children. I don't care what time frame it is. It's 10,000 years ago or 10 minutes ago, kids are going to screw things up. That's and hilarious. They're going to draw on the walls. Yeah. So, I mean, you can't stop that. But if you don't see that,
Yeah.
If you don't see that on that kind of a wall, that probably means they weren't there. You know what I mean? Because that stuff never goes away. It's not like they could have erased it when the kid went up and screwed up their rock art. You know, I mean, it would still be there. And we just don't see that from my experience. But I don't know if that's been studied or if we have any clear cut examples of that. But that would definitely lend credence to the shamanistic nature of it or the religious nature of it, because it would have been more of a solitary or sacred type of thing that they were doing.
But turning the tables on this completely, of course, as always, some of the newest evidence shows that some of the imagery, oftentimes it's even, you know, a fair amount of it, came from not adults, but juveniles and females.
Yeah.
So they've analyzed the hands that appear on some of the oldest rock art, and they're females. They're young women. And also, I guess the analysis of some of the pigment has allowed for DNA. And again, they find that they can genetically identify the sex, the gender, and it's from a woman, not a man.
Wow. That's really cool. I didn't know that. Yeah. On that note, that's a really good place to stop this. Alan and I, when we started this, we came up with a list of about 12 or 13 things to talk about. That's number one and segment one. So we'll see if we get through number two in segment two, back in a minute.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencaster. That's Zencastr. Zencaster allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencaster does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to Zencastr.com and use the code ROCKART. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on price and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
Welcome back to the Rock Art Podcast, episode 25, and I am your temporary co-host, Chris Webster, with Dr. Alan Garfinkel. So, you know, we spent the whole first segment, Alan, talking about basically defining the word rock art, and I think we probably asked more questions than we answered, but that's the nature of science and the nature of archaeology. So we leave it up to the listener to make their own interpretations and do their own research and see what they think about this.
Absolutely.
So let's go a little different direction. Yeah.
Yeah. So needless to say, we can define rock art as referring to these drawings and paintings that are made by indigenous people on rock surfaces. Mm-hmm. But how do they make them? Well, they make them in a variety of ways. They, in fact, can paint them. They can peck them. But they can also scrape away the earth to reveal the underlying soil that is lighter.
Right.
There's a number of different types of this rock art. So I guess the major techniques that we use to create rock art and the terminology we use, we call these things that are paintings, at least in America, we call them pictographs, P-I-C-T-O-G-R-A-P-H-S. And when we peck or scrape or incise, we call them petroglyphs or rock drawings. Now, when the figures get rather large, or when rather than a standing rock or some sort of, you know, some sort of a portable boulder is used, those will be pictographs and petroglyphs. But if we have something on the desert plain, be it rock alignment or what we're calling giant gravel figures or figurines, we use a number of different terms for them. We call them intaglios, I-N-T-A-G-L-I-O-S, or geoglyphs. And within that intaglios or geoglyphs element, we have this thing that we call rock alignments. And these can be similar. They can be abstract, linear, or curvilinear designs, and they also can be representative of certain figures. You know, they can represent either animals or supernatural beings as well. So, In the pictographs realm, it means a painted rock picture. And most commonly, the colors that are most popular in pictographs, I believe around the world, is black, white, and red. And I believe red is certainly the most popular color. And the red pigment comes from an iron oxide. They use the term red ochre. They also use the term hematite or hematite. Mm-hmm. So that's a pigment that's found naturally in many soils. And it's one of the most common pigment in the world. And of course, in the red is associated with blood. It's associated with life. It's associated with being positive and also with the earth. So that's our red pigment. And red pigment was used on rock art and on other artifacts as well to paint them, I would say, back for the last 40, 50, 60, 70, 100, or 200,000 years. I think they're finding now that some of the earliest rock art was actually done by a different species of humans, the Neanderthals. And now they're finding that those were painted and they were abstract. But I just learned the other day that there was some new and ancient images found that are actually representational rock art as well, that go back to the equivalent of that, that actually have imagery of animal human figures that go back to that same age. So that's quite amazing, I think.
Yeah, that really is. You know, and we also have the combinations of various techniques, right? So you could have like an incised or pecked petroglyph that's been painted along the grooves.
Yeah, I've seen that very rarely, but I've seen it. And sometimes, of course, the paint is not incised, but it's somehow ensconced. It's layered on the petroglyphs. I know that even in the Coso Range of Eastern California, if you look closely at some of the largest images of bighorn sheep, you'll notice that there's remnants of red pigment that are in the actual pecked out elements, the lines of those figures preserved.
Do you think that was more common and we don't visualize it that way today because not a lot of it persists? Or you see like older images of Roman temples and like Egyptian pyramids and stuff like that, and they're, you know, covered in gold and alabaster and some other things, right, and we just don't visualize it that way because it doesn't look like that today.
So yeah, I think that color was rather important to the ancients, to the native people, the indigenous people as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that they would have had those drawings and paintings painted and sometimes as colorful as they can. Of course, the black pigment is associated with death and war and the underworld. And sometimes it's charcoal, but other times it's a manganese oxide, as it's called. And then some of the rarer paints are white. It's either chalk or limestone, diatomaceous earth, and the white doesn't preserve very well. Sometimes it's ash from wood fires and sometimes shell. And the yellow is limonite. The green is some of the rarest. It's malachite or a copper-rich mineral. And we have a few paintings that have that green pigment in them. In the eastern Mojave Desert, about, I don't know, I think it was 60% of the paintings that were shown at Newberry Cave in the eastern Mojave Desert, in this very famous cave site, were made of a green selenite, a volcanic mineral pigment. And then when green was available, or I know that the Chumash used actually true green pigment sometimes, but also they use this sort of visual green or visual blue, as it's called, where they used a gray color, and when you see it, your eye tricks you, and it believes it's green or blue. Wow. And I'm serious. I don't know if you've studied that.
No.
But that's amazing to me that does that. And blue, of course, is the rarest, and it's azurite or cuprite, etc. And it's also interesting in terms of studying color that in many cultures throughout the world, they don't distinguish between green or blue. They're the same color. And this green blue has a single word. Mm-hmm. And in the western Mojave Desert, the far southern Sierra, the Tehachapi Mountains of California, there's a mountain in Jawbone Canyon that's called Blue Point. And in the native language, it was called blue. And when you look at it, mm-hmm. I swear it's green, not blue. But at different times of the day and with the different sunlight or the different cloud cover, it changes color. It looks green. It looks blue. It looks this, it looks that. But I've always been fascinated by that particular landform. And then right across the street from it, there's a spring, and then there's a painting right there across the way. But it's not in green or blue. It's red. So there you go again, right?
That's right. I mean, I'm just wondering, as sort of an aside, could you imagine walking through something like Little Petroglyph Canyon, like we've talked about here, with the thousands and thousands of images, and have them be painted? I mean,
man,
that would have been phenomenal to see. Now, they're of many different time frames, more than likely. It wasn't used over like a summer or created in, you know, in a single event or anything. So maybe at various times they would have been painted. But I wonder if they would have been maintained, you know what I mean? Through generations, like would somebody have come back and maintained the color as it fades away? And then why they stopped?
Well, they certainly maintained the pecking.
Yeah.
Because later on, and we're talking hundreds or thousands of years, we find that those ancient images are refreshed and recharged with fresh pecking, and they produce a much lighter and brighter image. And that also kind of throws archaeologists and rock art researchers a curveball, because when they're looking at that and they're trying to date those sites by their freshness or their superimposition or the styles of the rock art, they are confounded by the fact that the images, some of the images, appear far fresher and newer than their age of origin. And I've noticed that you know, sort of conflated and made it far more difficult for someone to understand the actual original age and the associated stylistic elements that go with certain periods of time and cultures in the Kosos. It's taken me about 40 years or more to sort of develop a chronology of the rock art of the Kosos because of that issue.
Yeah. You know, while we're also talking about, you know, incised or etched or pecked rock art or petroglyphs and also painted versus pictographs, you often see one or the other, right? Now, leaving aside the fact that a lot of incised or pecked rock art could have been painted at one point in time, because we also see, and you've been down, I think, down on like the Baja Peninsula and areas like that, where you get these big canvases that are purely painted. And like the caves at Lascaux over in France, you know, they're all painted. Do you know, or is there any evidence that you've heard of that could say whether this was a cultural decision or was it a functional decision? Like the rock was, I don't know, too hard to really manage any sort of proper drawing, or maybe they just had an abundance of whatever pigments they were using available. I mean, do you have any idea what some of the reasoning behind that might be, or is it something we'll just never know the answer to?
No, I think I can, you know, wrap a bit on that particular topic because I have some ethnographic evidence that will support my argument. For instance, when you're looking at the far Southern Sierra Nevadas, which is this huge granite batholith, right? And you go there, the predominant or most exclusive manner of executing, crafting rock art by the indigenous Indians, the famous Tabatalabal or Pinyon Pine Nut Eaters of the South Fork of the Kern River, they paint their rock art, okay? But when you go to the Central Sierra and the Northern Sierras, guess what? They peck their rock art. It's on the same canvas. It's the same granite rock art. And they do this, do their imagery that is a signature of their culture, but they use an entirely different technique. Why would they do that? I don't know. Sounds like it's a cultural, you know, option as to how they execute it, because they've got the same canvas. They've got the same materials available to them.
Sure.
But it sounds like it was a cultural decision and one that produces a signature or an identification of who they are and what they believe on the rocks.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, indeed. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the, in a little bit more detail, some of the techniques for creating some of this stuff, because we mentioned, and we'll just start with petroglyphs, right? Straight up incised or etched rock art, which I think for a lot of people might be the first image that comes to mind when they think of something like this. I don't know. For me, that's what comes to mind. For others, it might be like the caves of Lascaux painted, you know, the handprints, stuff like that. I don't know what comes to people's mind when they first think of rock art, now that I'm saying about that. But for me, it's a typical incised thing.
Yeah. And so I think if you look at the percentages of rock art across the world, at least in certain areas, it's more popular or it's more ubiquitous. There's more of it with respect to rock drawings or petroglyphs. Now, the way those are made, at least in some instances, is if they have a rock canvas that then ages or accretes, that's a good word, a desert varnish or a sort of an element to its patina, then if one pecks through that veneer, then you can expose the heart rock, which is lighter, and you can make a picture. And those pictures, after being pecked with some sort of hard stone hammer, it's often made of white quartz because it's more resilient and harder than the canvas itself, then we create a picture. And those images are sometimes done directly by percussion or indirectly using sort of a, you know, a chisel or a hammer, which allows for a little greater precision. So you have a couple of different ways there of producing these rock drawings. But it's mainly by abrading or creating these drawings by actually pecking into the rock or incising some sort of image. And I guess throughout North America, throughout the West, the oldest imagery is nearly exclusively, some would argue exclusively, abstract and not representational. So we have these curvilinear or rectilinear abstract images that we believe, and there is a lot of convincing and growing evidence to support that position, that those are the oldest images that we see in sort of North America. How's that?
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting. I would imagine, I was thinking of this when you said it, that it's more the incised or pecked drawings is more ubiquitous, probably because it's easier to do, right? Most of the time you're like, well, that looks like a good wall to do something on, pick up a rock and start working on it. But with pictographs or any sort of painting, well, you got to source the material and make the pigment, and it's not a quick and easy process that you can just, you know, pull red ochre off a plant and smear it on the wall. It just doesn't work that way.
It's very labor intensive to do the paintings. As you say, you have to make paint, and you just don't get a lump of pigment, because if the pigment was used directly on rock, it would wash away. It needs to be a paint. So there needs a binder. And normally it's an animal fat or vegetal material to create a binder. And then the reason the red preserves so well, it becomes part of the rock. It actually is sort of saturating the rock, and it stains the rock in such a way that it preserves. So that's interesting unto itself.
Nice. All right. Well, we're going to take our second break. When we come back, I want to continue on this techniques thread and talk a little bit more about pictographs, because I think one of the other things people probably think of when they think of rock art, especially when they think of, as I mentioned before, the caves of Lascaux, but that's certainly not the only place, is the handprints, like handprints on a wall or something like that. So let's maybe talk about that a little bit when we come back for segment three, and we'll see if we can knock out one or two more questions on our big list of questions. Back in a minute. You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show. Welcome back to the third and final segment of episode 25 of the Rock Art Podcast. I'm Chris Webster, and as always, we are here with Dr. Alan Garfinkel. So, Alan, as we mentioned in the last segment, let's move on to pictographs and how those are created. And the one thing I'm particularly interested in and intrigued by is when somebody thinks of pictographs, a lot of times, and you know, or rock paintings, for a more colloquial term, they might think of like the paintings of Lascaux, as we mentioned a few times, and there are a lot of handprints on those, and that's not unique to there. I mean, you see that in a lot of different places around the world, which makes me kind of wonder, as a side question, are there signature type items with more etched or incised rock drawings, or is it just easier to do with handprints? I don't know, but let's talk about techniques for maybe creating those pictographs. Were they painted on with brushes? Did they spit them out their mouth, which I've heard about before? What kind of techniques are you aware of?
So pictographs, paintings, rock paintings, they're applied in a number of different ways. You can use your fingers, you can use your hands. The hands are dipped in paint as common symbols, and they're applied directly onto the rock. And sometimes they use brushes from plant fibers, a yucca brush or animal hair. And as you're well aware, they sometimes actually do a reverse kind of a image, in which they put the pigment in their mouth, they place their hand on the rock, and they spit the paint out at the hand, and it has an inverse relationship. It has a reverse picture. Then the paint allows the image of the hand to be depicted. Now, I think we mentioned again that either on this show or not, that we can identify the gender and sometimes even the age of the people that are represented by those hands. And they have been found to be often women, and young women at that. They're predominantly women and not always men. And then, of course, they've also found that some of those artists are, in fact, women. And that's rather interesting, because the conventional wisdom was also that these were always predominantly men.
Is there just to kind of walk that back for a second, though, as a skeptic myself, I'm always asking questions, right? And sort of questioning common held beliefs, for lack of a better word. But my first thing I thought of, yeah, when you said that was, well, can we prove that the person whose hand is represented on the wall is the same person that actually was spitting the pigment at the hand?
No.
Or was there a pigment spitter in the cave and people were putting their hands on the walls?
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about it in that way, but you're probably right. Someone else might have spit the pigment, and that could have been a woman or a man. But the interesting thing is because of the dimensions of the fingers, they have found that there's a distinctive association between those dimensions and the gender, the sex of the actual individual, and of course their age. So I find that to be, you know, just another really amazing thing.
Yeah, that's really cool.
The pigments that they use are sometimes like a crayon or a charred stick or a chalk-like rock. And both dry and liquid pigment are sometimes blown even through a tube or sprayed from the mouth onto the rocks. And again, that spraying produces a bit of a negative image. And the painting, this pigment application, was not only on rocks, it was used on their faces, bodies, clothing, artifacts. And many times we can get a sense of the imagery or the significance of that by looking at some of the archival materials that are available in the museums, and they help us better understand some of the significance and meaning and associations of these paintings on the rocks, because of the paintings that were adorning various kinds of people and rituals and tattoos. And they painted both their bows, their arrows, their darts, and other ritual and non-ritual kinds of objects. So all of that and much more.
Absolutely. It's so cool. Just thinking about those types of techniques. And not only that, but how, like, I understand how incising or pecking or just in some way affecting a rock by removing material is somewhat ubiquitous around the planet, because you pick something up, even if you accidentally go to throw a rock at somebody and you miss and you hit the wall, you'll notice that, hey, that has an impact on that wall, so to speak. And you can see the difference. You can see the patina worn away, or you can see the hole that was made or something like that. And it doesn't take long to put two and two together and say, well, I could do this intentionally and then, you know, make certain shapes and drawings and do stuff with those. But to create these pigments for what seems like almost no other purpose. I mean, I'm sure they were painting them on themselves and things like that as well, but what other purpose would these pigments have had? And then, like you said, it's not just picking it off a tree. You have to mix it with other materials, the binding agent, and get it up there. So there was a very intentional aspect to this rock art, which, you know, you mentioned that a lot of the earlier rock art that is incised is more abstract. What about the earlier pictographs? Are those also more abstract, or are they a little more advanced along with the techniques it took to create them?
In some instances, they're abstract. But if you think about it worldwide, and this has always been a bit of a conundrum and a mystery to me, when you're looking at some of the earliest paintings that are known, like from Lascaux and Chauvet, we're talking about 40, 50, or even 60,000 years ago, they have the most realistic, colorful, and phenomenally rendered images of animals in a very vital and motion-filled cast. And you go, wow, where did that come from? Because there is nothing earlier than that to sort of demonstrate some sort of a genealogy or a developmental cycle to those images. The other kinds of rock art that we were talking about or haven't talked about, but people have a great interest in, is when there are pits and grooves that are placed on rocks. And one of them is called the pit and groove style. But the other thing that people really like, because they're so ubiquitous and so old, the oldest form of rock art, is little cups that are called cupules or cupules. And this has been some of the oldest rock art ever discovered on the planet. And these cupules are often found in association with bedrock mortars that, of course, are more conventionally understood as the processing, these rotary grinders that are used to process seeds, nuts, and sometimes other foods, including meat. And we find them at villages. I think the interesting feature about cupules is we really don't know exactly what they're used for. We do have ethnographic evidence that they sometimes are called baby rocks, sometimes called rain rocks, sometimes identified as a means of communicating with the supernatural realm and ensuring a healthy child or being able to have a child. So they're called fertility rocks as well. They are still being used to this very day. The Yokuts still use them. These are the native people of the Central Valley of California. And they will peck the rock and have this rock flower, as it's called, and then smear it on their body to ensure that they will be a fertile person and be able to procreate and birth babies.
Wait, when you say like rock flower, you mean like actual, like the dust from creating it?
Right. So you create a cup, you create the cup by pounding it with some sort of a implement, something like a pestle, I would presume, but a smaller one, not a large one. And then you would in fact then take that rock flower and then smear it upon your body in some way, sometimes on your genitals. And you would then presume that sort of activity would then have supernaturally allowed one to then be able to procreate and birth babies and have a healthy child. Or in other instances, just the action of doing that would be a way to communicate to the supernatural world, the creator or the various deities that one has, that one would like to see rain come. And by doing so, they were called rain rocks as well.
Okay.
But I think in the big picture, if you think about rain and you think about the concept of fertility, I think we can put that under one umbrella and call it increase rights. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to enforce a request and we're taking an action and then using that action to communicate a need for increase. Fertility would be sustainability. Rain, again, is something that we need for water and for the replenishment of the earth, both for plants and animals. And so I think this all kind of, you know, falls into one sort of realm, a cosmological realm that I like to think about. And the anthropologists call it increase rites. They're rituals and activities, ceremonies that are involved with creation and renewal and revivification. I know those are all, you know, sort of abstract terms, but I think you get my drift, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it always comes back down to ritual, right?
Right, but it doesn't, it's not that different, me being Catholic and also originally Jewish. I can just throw it all together and examine comparative religion from a variety of standpoints. But when you go to church on Easter, we're celebrating rebirth. It's spring, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a rebirth or reiteration or renewal ceremony. So we look at both death as a destination, but also a conduit of transformation. And we view from a standpoint of sort of understanding the nature of the world, the nature of the universe in a way, in the same way as native people would. How do you say that, Alan? Well, think about it. Where do they put the dead Jesus? They put him in a vessel, a darkened vessel, which was a cave. And from the cave, he is reborn. Well, that was the same concept that natives had, was that there was a cave, a portal. Caves are conduits or sort of connections, tethers from the supernatural world to the natural world. And these are where places of rebirth. And so typically people are created and the world was created from the underworld. And then it becomes terrestrial. It becomes something on the earthen sphere. And often the cosmos and the deities and the creators and the most sacred things are up in the sky. Hmm. So it's the sky world where rain comes from. And so it's a conduit. It's a cycle. It's a, you know, a huge sort of transformational, what would you call it, journey.
Yeah.
And so when one sort of wraps their mind around it, there's similarities and if you want to understand rock art, you've got to then sometimes understand the nature of religious metaphor. How's that?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, indeed. And it's really difficult to understand that too, because I mean, religion is so differently defined. I mean, there are some commonalities around the world with various religions, but there's also some glaring differences in how those were not only practiced, but developed through time and how people, I guess, interacted with it, for lack of a better way to say that. So, I mean, even like you said, Catholicism, you know, even that's changed as steadfast and rock steady as it seems to be sometimes. It's definitely changed over hundreds of years, you know, maybe an interpretation or practice or something like that, but there's definitely changes. So I can imagine the change that would have taken place on a smaller scale with groups that were smaller and isolated from other groups and, you know, shared some common individualities. So yeah, it's interesting.
I think though, if I'm able to sort of jump in here, I think religion and hearkening back to rock art again,
mm-hmm.
and archaeology, it is surprising and almost revelatory in some ways to see the continuous nature and stability of religious thought as opposed to its differentiation or transmogrification or transformation. So if I give you an example, in Little Petroglyph Canyon, there appears to be an image, a petroglyph, a rock drawing, that looks to be a depiction of a creation story. And that creation story is one that harkens back, at least for the last, I would say at the earliest, it has to be kind of maybe about, well, how would I say this? Maybe about 2000 BC. So it's 4,000 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same story. Wow. that in certain realms is still being expressed to this very day with the Huichol native people. And it's also it's a story of creation. It's the underworld. It's the beings that are coming to create the sun. It's also about the moon. It's about the female and the woman and all of that. And again, so that particular image, besides being perceived there in the Western Great Basin, is also down there on the northern border of Mexico and Texas. It also appears as part of the cosmology in the American Southwest. And then moving on down into Mesoamerica amongst the Aztecs. So there's a tremendous interconnection of religious thought and even language that brings one together in an interesting cycle. Traditions, and certainly religious traditions, tend to be stable for hundreds and thousands of years, which is amazing.
Yeah, that is amazing. Well, as a final thought, perhaps the rock art, rock drawings, rock etchings, rock alignments, all this stuff was maybe somewhat collectively, I don't know if designed is the right word, but helped to at least maintain those traditions. You know, they're maintained for thousands of years. These things don't disappear for thousands of years. They're a constant reminder of your ancestors and what they created and what they were trying to symbolize on the rock art. So it's really no surprise that those traditions would persist for that long. So that does make sense.
And Sandy Rogers, who was the director in the past of the right there in the Matarango Museum in Ridgecrest, actually worked with a native person talking about rock drawings in the area of the Coso Range and other areas certainly as well. And the native person called them storyboards, and that they were used as instructional ways to teach the basic ritual cosmology creation stories of the native people to the youngsters. So as they grew up, they would understand. Anyways, these were oral cultures. These had oral traditions, and it was a culture that was much more auditory than it was literary.
Well, with that, I think we'll call an end to this episode. We've got a number of topics left that we came up with, so I think we'll tackle those over the next few weeks and months. We've also got some guests coming up, so we'll get back on track and keep bringing you fantastic stuff. So thanks again, Alan, and thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thank you, Chris. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. You can find this podcast on the educational podcast app Lyceum, L-Y-C-E-U-M, and wherever you find podcasts. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by David Ian Howe and by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.